Session number 8397, William Sparks, part one.
When were you born, Mr. Sparks?
I was born in the East End of London, 1922.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father was a GPO telephone engineer. Prior to that, he spent a long time in the Royal Navy. He came out of the Royal Navy, I think, soon after I was born.
And how old were you when you left school?
When I... Beg your pardon?
Left school.
I left school about 16.
To do what?
When I left, there wasn't a lot doing at the time, and I took apprenticeship as a shoe repairer and maker, which I was doing until war was imminent. Then I joined the Royal Marines. I spent about 6 years in the Royal Marines. I came out in 1946.
Were you a conscript in the Marines?
No, I signed on for 12 years. The time I joined, there were no conscripts. They were only taking long service ratings in the Marines at that time.
Why did you decide to go into the Marines?
Well, first of all, I thought I'd follow my father's footsteps and join the Navy. Having got up the recruiting centre at Whitehall, saw all these pictures of Royal Marines in their white helmets and so forth, plus the fact that my old granddad was an ex-Blue Marine, and I think this rather swayed me.
And where did you do your early training?
Early training was done at Deal.
How did you find it?
Very, very hard. They used to boast that you either walked out of Deal as a Marine or were carried out on a gun carriage. And in those days, it was very hard. But looking back now, I suppose really they were some of the most enjoyable days of service life.
When was that?
I don't know, really. Used to get into trouble, obviously. I think I'd done more extra drills than anybody else in my squad. And this used to be a giggle, I suppose, although it was silly when you think of it. But I think I thoroughly enjoyed the training. I like gravel punching, and I suppose I just like the training.
Did many people not make the course, finish the course?
There were some. Of course, in those days, by the time we'd finished training, war was well going. And then, of course, once in, you couldn't get out. But I believe today they're very, very choosy. You've got a job to keep in today.
How did you come to join RMBPD?
I spent the first 2 years of the war on HMS Renown. And we were doing duties up in Iceland, where somehow or other I managed to get myself wringing wet and caught bronchial pneumonia. I was invalided off the Renown, sent back to barracks, and found out that they were asking for volunteers for a special service unit. Being young and silly those days, I suppose, I volunteered. We had an interview by Major Hasler, and he chose a number of men, and then we found ourselves down at Portsmouth training with the RMBPD.
What was the attraction to you doing special service?
I think the main attraction was a little earlier in the war, I'd lost a brother and in the Navy, and being young, I suppose, special service gave me a chance of revenge, I suppose.
Was there any apprehension on your part about what it might involve, the dangers that it might involve?
Not a bit. In those days, I used to volunteer for everything. But I never ever thought about what it may involve.
What did Hasler tell you that it involved when you first met him?
When we had the interview, he told us that it would involve operations in small boats, possibly many operations on enemy-occupied soil. And this was about all that he let us know.
Now, can you tell me what the training involved?
Training involved, I suppose, pretty near everything. Assault courses, mainly canoeing. For cover, RMBPD, Royal Marine Boom Patrol Detachment. That was our cover name for prying eyes. We were supposed to patrol the boom that stretched from Portsmouth to the Isle of Wight. Supposedly a game for two men submarines entering. And we used to be equipped with five-pound depth charges to attack and so forth. And I suppose this was the bulk of our training. Assault courses, of course, we did every day. They were self-made assault courses. which resulted in many men being taken to Hasler Hospital. They got fed up with us there, I think.
To which hospital?
Hasler Hospital. This is the naval hospital in Portsmouth. And this way, of course, it was a way of whittling down, I suppose. We used to do exercises where we were dropped somewhere by lorry, somewhere in the country, and told to make our own way back with no money in our pockets and be sure we evaded capture from police, etc. And I suppose this was the sort of exercises that we were doing all the time. But in the main, canoeing.
Which part of the training did you like best?
I think the canoeing we got very, very popular with. I think mainly once out in the sea, you were alone. There were just two of you in a canoe and you were alone, although, of course, under orders and possibly in convoy, but you more individual, I suppose. It was a great thrill when we were doing exercises, when we used to attack airdromes. We used to penetrate our naval defences, harbours, etc. And it was a great thrill and a lot of pride to us to get in and out undiscovered.
Was there any part of the training which you didn't like?
Possibly the assault courses. One of Major Hasler, one of his pets them in those days, when it was right in the middle of winter, snow on the ground, and he would run us up and down the beach at Southsea, barefooted on the pebbles, and then finish up with a swim in the sea. This didn't go down too well at all.
Did people grumble about it?
No, nobody ever grumbled. I think we were afraid that if we grumbled, we would be sent back to unit, and nobody wanted this.
Why were people so scared of being sent back to the unit?
I think it was a matter of pride. This RMBPD unit was a very select crowd, and we were so proud that we had been chosen for it out of the hundreds that he must have interviewed, that to be sent back, I think, would have been a sort of disgrace. It's like saying that you couldn't make the grade.
What was morale like in the unit?
Morale was terrific. The men worked very, very closely together. They were very, very friendly. And it was just a little unit that were wrapped up in one another. Everybody helped each other. And many a time when we first started training, someone would tip over in the canoe. And immediately all hands were there to help them back to shore. And the morale was very, very high.
Did anybody get sent back in the event?
Oh, there were quite a few. Some just couldn't make the grade. After a time, the major used to call them along and say, well, I don't think you're the sort of material for this unit, and they were sent back. Some were sent back, as I say, through injuries, through our assault courses, and they would lose too much training by the time they recovered. There was nobody that volunteered to go back. Everybody that went back was sent back as unsuitable or medically unsuitable.
How did the men react when they were told that they weren't the right material?
Oh dear, shocking. Just like they went in mourning all of a sudden, they felt rejected, didn't want to speak to anybody, and all they wanted to do was get away as soon as they can and forget the unit.
Can you remember any of the injuries?
There was a broken leg. Oh, lots of dislocated limbs. And generally speaking, this was it, dislocated limbs, bad backs where they fell, and or perhaps the strain was too much for them.
Were you ever injured yourself?
Not at all, no. No, I was very lucky, I suppose, in this respect.
Was injury just a matter of luck or carelessness or what?
I don't think it was carelessness, because our assault courses, we made them as we went along. And quite possibly, you know, they wouldn't pass standard today because they would be unsuitable or unsafe for today. I think possibly this had something to do with it, that our assault courses were self-made and as such were not really safe. But there you go.
What was the first operation you prepared for?
The first operation we prepared for was Operation Frankton.
And can you tell me what the preparation involved?
The preparation involved many, many hours of canoeing, living off compact rations, and then working from submarines, preparing to or learning how to launch our canoes and slip away. And then we eventually finished up with a huge exercise where we went from Margate to try and penetrate into London, into the docks of London, which should have taken us 5 days. And it worked out that this was a replica of Operation Frankton Raid.
How long did it take you in actual
fact? It took us 5 days, but ironically, the only two that really got through the course was Major Haslow and I. I, of course, was in his canoe. The others were either captured by home guards and various patrols, or capsized and had trouble this way. And ironically, the only two that got through were Major Haslow and I, and we were the only two that came back from the operation.
Can you describe a few of the details of what happened to you on that practice?
On the exercise, mainly navigation was a big thing to us then, because for a canoe there's a terrific lot of navigation to be learned. And not only do you have to plot your course, you have to know the strength of tides, strength of winds. All these can throw you off, and a few degrees out at sea and you could be miles away from your target. That was the main thing. Secondary was the fact that defences had been alerted that we were coming and were obviously on the lookout for us. And therefore, you know, we were challenged many times. But one of our practices was to just lay still and float along the tide, and we were so camouflaged that to the eyes ashore we would look like a floating log, and invariably we would get away with it. Of course, if we were challenged too many times, then we would have to surrender in case they fired at us.
Did you have any narrow escapes on that practice?
Major and I had no narrow escapes. I believe some of the boys did. One was even fired at by Home Guard, another one was captured by an RAF launch, and I think a couple of others capsized, had to swim ashore, lost all their equipment, and they managed to save their canoe. But apart from that, we had no escapes, really.
If the authorities were deliberately alerted to the fact that you were coming, what didn't that make it more difficult than Operation
Frankton? Oh, yes. This was the idea. I think the Thames would have been far easier to have penetrated than our actual area in wartime. I don't know why, perhaps it was a lackadaisical ways of our part, but it would have been far easier for us to have penetrated had the authorities not been alerted. So to make it more difficult, they were alerted. Of course, this was good for them. It gave them exercising as well.
What other preparations did you make for the operation?
We used to stay out overnight on Dartmoor, wake up in the morning with frost over our chest and so forth, live off the land if we never had compact rations. Generally speaking, we were just sort of thrown out into the moors and said, well, see you back at such and such a place in 3 days' time, and you just had to live the best you can. Avoid detection, of course, live the best you can, and you were expected to arrive on time and fit.
Did you know the objective of the of what you were preparing for at the time?
No. We knew we were preparing to attack shipping. And when the operation eventually loomed up, we boarded a submarine in Scotland and we set sail. And we were all convinced that we were going after the Tirpitz, although looking back now would have been really stupid. But we were convinced we were going back to the going after the Tirpitz. And the rumour got so strong that the Major eventually got us together and told us to stop these rumours. He said, as you know, rumours can sometimes prove right, and this convinced us we were right. And it wasn't until we were a day out on the submarine that he called us all together in the torpedo room of the submarine. Well, he said, I'm sorry to disappoint you, it's not the Tirpitz. And then he explained that we were going after shipping in Bordeaux, which, to my mind, I was very, very grateful. I'd rather gone to France and Norway any time.
Because of the climate?
Yes, exactly. And somehow or other, I don't know, France seemed near at home to get home.
Which submarine was it that took you out?
We went on the T-class, a submarine Tuna.
Can you describe what happened to you aboard the submarine?
When we left Scotland, we were still on the fore casing, taking the salute, naturally. And it took us 5 days to get to the Bay of Biscay. Well, the first 3 days, we hit some violent weather, and I think the majority of us were seasick, not being used to submarines rolling. And then the major thought that it was getting so serious that he eventually called us together and told us that it was only a question of mind over matter, and the next one that was seasick wouldn't come in the operation. And funnily enough, there was nobody seasick after that. But apart from that, as passengers on a submarine, it's really very, very boring, and I suppose demoralising. All the sailors have got their jobs to do, and did it marvellously well, and us being passengers, we just had to keep out of their way. So for 24 hours a day, we just kept out of their way the best we could. When we got to the Bay of Biscay, we had a little excitement. A U-boat had picked up. Whether they were stalking us or we were stalking them, I suppose obviously we were stalking them as well. But this went on for a few hours, and eventually we lost contact. But that was about the only little bit of excitement that we really had.
You were informed about this, were you?
Oh, yes. The sailors used to keep us informed of everything that happened. I think they delighted in coming telling us. They knew we had nothing to do with it, you know.
What happened next?
We surfaced on the night that we should have gone over the side, and there was a violent Bay of Biscay storm, and the submarine was rolling so violently, you know, we had to dive again to get out of the waves. And they decided that they would give it another 24 hours, and if it was still stormy, then the operation would have to be called off. Well, all day, the next day, we were submerged, hoping to dodge patrol boats and so forth. And when we surfaced the next night, the sea had completely changed. It was like a mill pond. So our operation was on, much to our pleasure, of course.
And then what?
Well, the object was to put six canoes with two men over the side. We were to leave the submarine in the Bay of Biscay, penetrate the defences at the Gironde, and eventually paddle up the Gironde to Bordeaux, which was to have taken us 5 nights, hiding by day, travelling by night. Once into Bordeaux, we were to attack armed merchant ships. Now, these armed merchant ships used to run from Bordeaux round to Japan with radar equipment and back again with other more war materials. It was estimated the fleet would have consisted of about 12 ships, believed to operate in two convoys of 2 sixes. Well, we got into Bordeaux, and I suppose we were very, very fortunate. We had 6 ships in the area. Having taken 5 days to get in, they reasoned that it would be too risky to ask a submarine to wait another 5 days for us to pick them up, plus the fact that with our navigation being so primitive as it was, there were chances that we wouldn't meet them, and plus the fact that the balloon would have gone up by that time. They decided that having done the job, we were to scuttle our canoes and make our way across occupied France to a little town, a little village called Ruffec, where hopefully we were to pick up the underground system.
Now, can you describe the raid in detail, step by step, please?
The first night when we left the submarine, we lost a canoe. It was damaged coming out of the hatchway. That now left us with 5 of our 6. We got waterborne, the submarine sailed away, and then we started paddling toward the mouth. Well, about 0.5 mile from the Gironde, we heard terrific, like a waterfall, and the major stopped, called us all round, and he said, "These are tidal races in front." Now, tidal races we had never ever had any experience of. He said, "Well, just use rough water drill, battle away," he said, "and then you'll go through them." Well, being with the major, we went through first, and I shall never forget those tidal races. They were terrific. The waves looked as though they were about 12 foot high, us being in canoes, and they tossed and threw us all over the show. And then eventually, just as quick as they started, we were through the other side. We waited, the second canoe came through, the third and the fourth, and the fifth canoe was missing. So we turned back to the tidal race to see if we could find any trace of them, but we found no trace whatsoever. We found out later that this canoe had capsized in the tidal race. The two men had got ashore, and within an hour they were picked up by a German patrol. We were now down to four canoes, and still travelling, we still hadn't entered the mouth of the Gironde. And then we hit a second tidal race. Once again we battled through, the second and third canoe came through, and the fourth one never made it. So once again we turned back, but we found this crew. Their canoe had capsized, and it was freezing bitter cold weather, and the two boys were in the water. Well, another canoe came back to help us. We got our knives out, scuttled their canoe, the one that capsized, and then each canoe took one of the lads in tow to try and get them as near shore as we could. Well, by this time, the tide was in danger of turning, and we hadn't yet entered the mouth, which meant that we could have been swept out into the Atlantic, and the operation, of course, would have gone. So we had to abandon the two boys. We wished them good luck, and told them the best way to get ashore, and they would hopefully be taken prisoners of war. Of these lads, we found that they were swept back out in the Atlantic. One was never found, and the other one's body was washed up somewhere around about the Brest area, I think. Now, the three canoes left, we had by now just about got to the mouth of the Gironde, where we were told to expect a patrol boat. And much to our disgust, when we got there, there were three patrol boats. Unknown to us, on this particular night, the enemy had decided to have an anti-invasion exercise. They were sweeping the sea with searchlights, and they doubled up on their sentries. Now, we had to pass between the patrol boat and a jetty. And clearly on the jetty we saw a sentry, German sentry. So, being with the CO, we went through first, and just as we got near them, the patrol boat started semaphoring, or signalling with a signal lamp. So our danger now was being silhouetted in the beam. We waited a little while, and they stopped signalling, and then we had to go through as quickly as we could, without making a noise, of course, passing right underneath the jetty with a sentry on. We passed the three boats and waited, and a little while later, the second boat came through. We both waited, and the third boat, by the time he got to about the middle patrol boat, they started signalling again. Well, we believe that he was seen. We heard a shout and a shot, and then we waited a little longer, and no sign of him. We eventually found out that he had evaded capture, and because he'd lost us, he tried to carry on his own, and he got almost to Bordeaux when his canoe was wrecked by an underwater obstacle of some sort. They had to swim ashore. They were eventually betrayed, handed over to the Germans, and taken away to Paris and shot. So we were now on the first night down to two canoes. And by now it was dangerously beginning to get a bit light, plus the tide turning. So we had to find what hide we could for the day. Well, we found what we thought was a little island and thought this would be ideal for us. Got ashore, had a bit of reconnaissance, seemed very deserted, and then we dragged our canoes up, the two canoes, camouflaged them up, and decided to get some rest. Major Hazard, of course, taking first watch. Well, as it got light, none of us could sleep anyway, but as it got light, we noticed some fishing vessels coming towards what we thought was our little island. And then coming from the mainland were a crowd of women and children. And apparently we've chosen the one spot to hide where the French fishermen used to meet their wives and children to have breakfast at dawn every morning. So, of course, they landed, or they came very near to our hiding places, so near that it was obvious they had to see us. Now, the Major was the only one that could speak French. And the only thing to do, he went out and spoke to these French people. Told them that we were British commandos here to do a job, and we hoped they would be patriotic Frenchmen and not give us away. Well, they promised that they wouldn't, but all that day, of course, we were on tenterhooks, hoping that no one, even a child, had mentioned a word and the Germans had picked it up. But thankfully, they hadn't. They'd kept quiet. Although that evening at dusk, we had an alarm, and just as it was getting dusk, we thought we saw a column of grey-clad figures approaching, And we were laying there, four of us, silly when you think of it, but we're laying there with our guns, ready to fight them off. And we waited and waited. And eventually, as it got darker, and the Major was watching through his glasses, and then he began to chuckle. They were a load of invasion stakes that we'd been watching. And in the dusk, of course, they looked like Germans. Then we launched our canoes, and the tide being completely out, and we had to pull them over about a quarter of a mile of mud. We were waist deep in it, and obviously trying to pull laden canoes as well. These canoes, incidentally, they had food and water for us for 5 days. Our limpet mines, which we had, I think, about 8 apiece, plus our personal gear, so they were very well laden down. Well, eventually we got to the water's edge and got launched. And the two canoes then carried on for that evening towards Bordeaux. Well, that evening was pretty uneventful, apart from the fact of patrol boats dashing up and down, because unknown to us then, these two lads, they had captured, because they'd captured them, they'd captured their canoe, the alarm had gone off, and they were now looking for us, although we didn't know at the time. Anyway, we dodged patrol boats all that night, and then come nearly dawn the next morning, we decided to look for our next day's laying-up place. We found a suitable position, pulled our canoes ashore, just got settled down, and then a little dog came running around barking. And naturally, his owner followed. And a Frenchman came along, and naturally he saw us. We asked him once again not to say anything, and we were there to do a job. And he insisted that we should go back to his house for a drink, which of course would have been fatal. We had to decline, but then once again, he was a good Frenchman, he never divulged. So that day was rather on thorns again, hoping that he hadn't spoken. But thankfully, come dark, we launched our canoes, and away we went again for the next night's paddling. A lot of activity on the river this night with patrol boats, but they didn't really worry us. And then come the next morning, somehow or other, we'd lost a bit of time, and it was getting dangerously light again. So we had to pull in as near as we, or as best we could, find the best cover we could. And we landed on a little island, and the Major got out to do a reconnaissance, came dashing back, pushed our canoe off. He said, quick, we'd landed right in the middle of an AKAK, German AKAK site. Well, by the time we'd got waterborne, it was now too light for us to commence paddling, so we had to once again pull in onto this island, put the two canoes in the middle of a field, throw our camouflage nets over us, and there we sat all day long. We were so close to this AKAK site, we could hear the Germans talking, laughing, singing, and even at one time, two Germans walked past us. Well, in this field was a herd of cows, and as cows got the funny habit of doing, they just stood in a big circle round us, just looking at us. And of course, when these two Germans came along, they stopped and looked at the cows, and we were dead sure then that this was going to be our lot. Or I don't know if it had been our lot or their lot, because we were armed with silent Stens. And naturally, all Stens was pointed at these two Germans. Had they have come too close, obviously, we'd have had to have killed them. But thankfully, they had a little laugh and walked away. Well, that was a very, very uncomfortable day. Couldn't get out of our canoes at all to stretch or anything. It rained all day long. We were very, very pleased to see, plus the fact that during the day,